Hello everybody, welcome to JJ's Album Club, a podcast where two J's interview famous musicians about albums they love. I'm one of the J's, I'm Joey Page, hello.
Hello, I'm Jimmy Bamarewa. It always makes me laugh because you are really always at pains to explain the name of the podcast. Like, people are like, when is he going to tell us what JJ's means? Come on, just man.
Get it out of the way. I want everyone to be clear. I don't want anyone to feel like they're hoodwinked.
Always good. Always good. But anyway, good to see you. It's a beautifully sunny day.
Yeah.
On the
I'm in a nice shirt.
10th of March. 9th of March.
9th of March.
In the year of our Lord and Plague 2021.
I don't think I'd ever heard the expression year of our Lord until about a year ago. Right. Now. It's one of the ones I hear it all the time now.
Like, yeah. No, it is one of those things that just becomes part of the lexicon, trying to think of an equivalent. Anyway, how are you, mate?
I'm all right. I feel like we've been a bit last day of term on this.
You can already tell the mob happy. Like, just listen. That's me playing Buckaroo in the background. Joe's wearing an outrageous thing that isn't his uniform. The teacher's just wheeled a telly in. It's all going to be great. Yeah, I feel like, yeah, we are possibly betraying the fact that, not that we're happy about it, because it's been a great series, but we are going out with a bang with this last episode of this batch. Are we bloody not? You don't want to damn the rest of our guests by saying save the best till last, but we certainly have saved
a very good one,
an absolute corker. Yes,
a parallel best with every single other guest on the podcast.
I think so. It's a tie. Baxter Jewelry, a total dude, a really inspiring artist, and a brilliant guy who was like, I feel like he started the conversation and he was like, I don't really know who these guys are, but was by the end of it, he was like,
I'll come on again.
Yeah, he was like, so much fun, fully on board, really great album choice, such a fascinating story as he's, you know, part of this amazing idiosyncratic rock dynasty. He talks a bit about his kid, his son sort of forays into music, and he's living in the house that he used to live in with his dad, Ian Jury, and he talks about that in a really fascinating way. He's written a book about that period. It was just a total joy, wasn't it?
Yeah, and especially for me, I bloody love Baxter Jury, and I didn't really hide that for one second in this interview. So see if you can see me melting under my LED streaming light.
Did you not want to say ring light there?
That's what I meant. I couldn't get the word out. Ring light.
I was like, wow, is ring light a brand?
And why have I got a ring light though for a podcast? Oh, it's because they're the Twitch streamer as well.
Oh my god, what's Twitch?
It's like YouTube, but interactive.
You gotta get that snappier. You gotta get that. You gotta speed that up.
It's an interactive YouTube.
Yes, perfect.
For comedy and mostly computer nerds.
You don't want to discourage the video game playing market, do you, Joe? Although that is very much on brand for you. You have been sort of thinning the herd of your fan base with insults for a while.
Yeah.
It's kind of your MO.
Yeah. I just say, like, if you want to come on Twitch and watch somebody doing a crossword, this ain't for you. This isn't an ASMR stream.
Well, see how it goes. But we've gone off topic because Baxter was great. As you were talking about the fact that he is a very important artist, and an artist feels like the right word, because we dug into 100%. His whole the kind of games he plays between the kind of character that he presents on stage and memorably in songs like Miami. And he really dives into that in a really fascinating way. And, you know, he feels like somebody who was there and was doing stuff, and then he kind of had this real creative breakthrough. And he's really eloquent, really fun, has a real sort of questioning relationship with it, and really taps into this. He talks about his dad's upbringing in a fascinating way, or his upbringing with his dad, rather. And he really taps into this kind of rich seam of slightly dysfunctional, mega creative, you know, weird London rock eccentrics. And it's really, really great. It was such an honour and a privilege. And I cannot think of a better way to put a little cap on this one, and then we'll see what the future brings.
And, you know, I've been
for the good shit, JJ's.
I've been doing, you know, interviewing people for about 5 years now. And Baxter has been on my list of people to interview for pretty much the whole time. So I retire. So yeah, no, it was really great to get this in, and and just really happy that he was like a really nice guy and interesting and fun to chat to.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's not gild the lily, because I think this one speaks for itself. So here we go. Here is our JJ's Album Club interview with Baxter Jewelry. We'll be back after this.
JJ's Album Club. So, yeah, I guess I'm going to get this out of the way first, Baxter, if I may. I'm very excited about this. Like, I'm a huge, huge fan of, like, I've been going to Jimmy, I can't believe we're doing this. And to the point, it's made me almost a bit like a fangirl. So I'm sorry about that in advance, but this is great.
That's better that you like that than not like that. I think it's
the alternative in an interview situation when it's like, I've been grudgingly asked to do this. There was no one else around. I've just quickly Googled you.
Maxwell Fury. Get that quite a lot, Max. Or the obvious one is like, I love that song. They'll get like a combination of one of your songs mixed with another one, and they really want to talk about that. And they go, oh, I love that I'm not the Miami person. But that's a fantastic effort. And then, how did your dad walk? And did he drink milk? I'm quite used to it, so
awesome.
This might be the opposite of that, hopefully.
Okay, I think it will be. I think we can confirm early on that it will be, but yeah, we really appreciate you. That's why. Yeah, we just really want to just go in hard on that. Finally, we've got you.
Has anyone watched Succession?
Yes.
No.
Yeah.
You like it?
I love it. Yeah, it's incredible. I mean,
it was fucking about it. It really reminded me of my upbringing. I was like, oh, there's us.
Wow. Anyway, go right. on, carry on. My God. Like the Roys, like Logan Roy. Yeah, yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. Obviously, Joe, you've got to watch it now.
I've got a lockdown, so I'll watch it while that's happening, I suppose.
It's incredible. It's
fucking absolutely one of the best things I've ever seen.
It's so good. Yeah. In fact, one of the major drawbacks of this global public health catastrophe is they were midway through. They were about to make series three, season three.
You're joking.
They've had to halt it. So I think they're going to try and film soon. So I'm just really gutted. Yeah, that's the real tragedy.
I've never found something by accident like that before. Where I've gone, oh my God, where the fuck was it? And I heard people whispering about it. Sorry, we shouldn't dedicate all our time to gushing. I just never don't like many things. And I was like, fuck. And I probably identify with it a little bit.
Well, we'll hopefully return to that, because that is a very tantalizing morsel. Joe, do you want to kick us off? Where should we start? Because we're on the brink of another lockdown. It feels you brought an album out kind of right at the advent of the first one. And it's just been a strange year, not just for everyone, but for musicians, especially artists, to get through it. How do you feel you've coped? How have you found it?
I mean, you know, you oscillate, mostly positive. We've got quite a good system at our house. I mean, to be honest, I'm very lucky that the Thames is just there. I'm looking at the Thames. So we live in this amazing gaff. It's my son and I that live here. Oh, and amazing. He's like an auto nerd. He's trying to get into Cambridge. Wow, so that he doesn't barely speak to me just because he thinks I'm just soil. You know what I mean? He's like, fuck you. And we're quite good. We got a music room. And about 6 months prior to the lockdown, I signed a book deal. That I probably had no intention of ever writing, and obviously as a result that's become my theme of lockdown, and it's been so difficult to do, but it just gave me something I hated doing to do, and that was just the same. And I progressively and incrementally got better, I think, or I felt like I did. That's just been a bit of a savior, really, because the album was a bit sacrificial. It felt a bit sacrificial, because you're like, the day of lockdown almost, we put it on, and I'm glad we did, but I wasn't in the spirit. It didn't become natural to me to sort of permanently sell it on social media and stuff. I just wasn't that guy, and it didn't feel right, and it sort of diluted the experience. And I think you're encouraged to be a bit like that, and I think some people, and when they're naturally brilliant at being like that, it makes sense. And maybe they sort of rise above this situation a bit better. But I just couldn't do that much or do that many gigs. And, you know, we're a bit of an experience live anyway, like in terms of it's quite raw. And then to put that down into something that's not well recorded with someone that can't sing in a shit suit.
Right,
it just doesn't work, you know what I mean?
Digitally, to do a kind of the whole Zoom gig thing, you didn't.
I
wonder if a lot of musicians, I wonder if a lot of musicians, kind of robbed of the kind of traditional markers of, you know, the album comes out, you tour it, you've got festivals, you've got this, it has this life, but, you know, and it's kind of, it's interesting to look back. I mean, I listened to the album earlier and it still sounds fantastic to me, but I wonder if there's an element of a lot of great stuff was released in that period, but it kind of got lost in this like morass of like everyone didn't really know what to kind of,
how to do with it or place it. And I'm happy because it's just another layer, and you've got to look forward. I can't look back. I don't even, it's history, and I'm happy about that. I can't look back. I think if the next tour got cancelled, I shouldn't say that. You're not allowed to say things like this. But I think if you know how they thought how you have these tours and they constantly
just move being moved down the line.
And it's really, to me, it's quite unrealistic that by February we're going to be, I mean, that's just not going to happen. We're not going to be playing tours in February. So then I think you'd have to stop it at that point, because you couldn't be playing that album 2 years after you did it.
Especially if you've not really been able to play it as well.
We played it once in Hastings.
Wow.
And the next day, the gig that we played, the next day, Jim Davidson was playing. I like the place and stuff, but that's the last gig I did. It's just before Jim Davidson.
I
know those places, where you get the posters and it's like Chubby Brown and all that, the glittering lights that fly.
I can beat that, right? So I was on, I do stand up comedy, and I was on a gig, and in the big room was Roy Chubby Brown on the same night as me in the little room. And I was absolutely furious that he's like outsold me by about 400 times, and I'm in the little side room.
He was very successful, wasn't he, though?
He still is.
I mean, he was another phenomenon. He's like a weird... Was that quite recently?
That was just before lockdown. That was in February.
Wow. Really? Yeah. He's still at it, right? He's still at it. I mean, he's another level from Jim Davidson, isn't he? He's like...
Yeah, I think so.
And
so... as we're about to go into another lockdown, what kind of little comforts have you kind of developed? Like, is there like a food or a certain little hobby that you never really got into before lockdown, outside of like, you know, a Netflix series or whatever?
All the cliches. I mean, I'm pretty I'm inherently a good cook, but I don't cook, so I was a shit cook. And then I and then I sort of discovered this really basic way of learning how to cook was through that company Gusto or whatever it's called. Post-prison experience where you get all the sort of relatively posh cuisine all apportioned into its right. And actually, I find it the most meditative thing. But I tried to cook without those, without that provision of all, you know, all those details. And then I hated it. So I have to have a little bit of ginger and paprika in the right little satchels for me to actually enjoy it. And then I've just done a 20-year trip. And I really like put the paprika in there, and a sweet potato. I'm lost for an hour and I love it.
Yeah,
I sort of pretend to everyone that I call my son that I cooked, and he obviously knows I didn't. We go through this fake ceremony, and it's but I really enjoyed it. But and it's really cheap, I find, and it's cheaper than Deliveroo, obviously.
Yeah,
and that's been quite a revelation. And I find television a bit claustrophobic to watch that too much. So I don't do much of that. I do a bit of training with a trainer dude. Just that middle class, quite expensive bloke that, but are you allowed to swear on that one?
Yeah, you do. You want?
Yeah. Please do.
Basically, calls you a cunt. And you think, why am I here? I really like him, and it's a bit like prison again. Actually,
yeah. You're sort of paying for these kind of penal, institutionalized experiences. Like,
it's like the thing is paisen. It's like a rubbish where you pay for prison experience, really. And so I do the cooking, and then I really enjoy that. And so, but as long as I've got those things, those small ceremonial ritualistic things, I'm kind of fine. Like, I'm not that bothered about the pub and stuff. I'm not that.
Yeah. Have you been out at all? Have you kind of, emancipated July the 4th? You know, me and Joe were out.
We were in the pub.
Like, I don't know how it, you know, and it was kind of fascinating to sit there and, you know, see how quickly people had adapted to the new situation. I can vividly remember me and Joe were sitting outside a pub like in Deptford, and it started raining slightly, and it had been sort of drizzling all day. And because of the whole outdoor thing, no one budged, like no one moved. This is a new piece of behaviour that's just literally been born in this moment. So, but yeah, have you been out?
The pubs open quite early along here because they're along the river and there's a kind of area. They created kind of hatches like really early on. They're the first pubs, I think, to open in London.
So we were kind of
on that in maybe May or something. Even though I paint a kind of dark character in my songs and stuff, and I've got a spine like a banana, you know what I mean? So for me to drink 6 pints, I'm going to be sick in my top pocket very quickly. But I did a few of those pocket sicking situations. And, but they were brilliant. They felt brilliant and liberating.
I think we all needed it. I wanted to ask about music, Baxter. Like, how have you? We've spoken to a few different musicians throughout this period, and it's been really interesting to hear the ways in which music has been a coping mechanism in terms of if people have got home studios. To what extent have people maybe felt like, oh, do you know what, I can't face it? There's been a whole rush of people releasing, you know, albums. Albums. To what extent did you kind of, what was the evolution of your journey with music? Were you already working on something?
I've got a kind of studio in there with lots of, it looks like a shop more because I've just put all, because there's no point in having a lockup anymore. I got all the stuff back, which is really enjoyable. But I put them in rows and rows. It just looks like a really shit shop. And then I switch them on every now and then. I think I was a bit musically fatigued because as the beginning of lockdown was the meant to be the start of the campaign. And I was so absorbed by doing all that up to that point. But to make more music really quickly just felt too much. I didn't have it in me really. And that's why I was quite blessed to be writing the book, which is another discipline or something. So, but then I've just, but my son is about 18, is pretty amazing, actually. I know everyone says that about the kids, but this is actually, I am actually telling the truth for once. He's a really smart musician.
Yeah.
So he's been in there writing a lot, and I've been kind of a bit bewildered by how good he is.
Wow.
Really, he can really sing, and he's all quite symmetrical and tall. I'm like, shit.
Well, you know,
it's really like,
we promised that we'd trash your dad, so it's like a succession up. You're one step up from him, and he's going to be one step up from you.
Ian Jury's grandson.
But that would be quite rare. Would you like to hope that he'll end up with some sort of musical career? Because that'd be quite rare to have a third generation musician.
I don't want to wish, I don't want it to be my wish, but I think he's quite in him, and I think he's actually really good. And I think he's got to go, and he's really smart, so he's going to try and get into, well, we're trying to get into Cambridge.
Wow. Amazing.
But I think already it's going to be hard for him to avoid, I think. People I work with haven't, their kind of A&R reflexes have kicked in when they've heard him.
Just like already, rubbing their hands.
They've already taken over, and he's already in the studio.
And he's already
been a posh producer already. And it's got So I'm like, fuck, here he goes. But he's already, I don't think there's any point in joining the music industry right now, is there?
No
university stuff. I think he needs to, I think it's an inevitability at the moment.
I was going to ask, and this kind of hopefully kind of ties in with, I know the book is, am I correct in thinking the book's about you growing up in the house with your dad?
Where I am now.
And so just seems crazy that, you know, your son's making music in the next room, and you're there, and you're reliving this. Was that a bit much at some points? Like, literally, kind
too
of
too much. Yeah, cannibalistic. You know, it's feeding off the same thing, perpetuating. But it's amazing how much generationally we changed. Not always for the best, but just we're different. Yeah. You know, I'm different.
Yeah.
We're a totally different relationship, an amazing place to be, the conditions are so different from when I lived here.
I was going to ask about that because it was a kind of correct me if I'm wrong, it was a kind of like your dad almost wanting to show you a certain part of life or a part of the world and stuff, and it was kind of a form of education in a way that he kind of brought you into this at times quite a terrifying place, it sounds like. What were some of the things that, I mean, I imagine it, you've been kind of reliving it through the book, and this could very quickly turn into a therapy session, but what has it been like? What were some of the memories of, and you mentioned the Succession parallel.
Succession parallel is unfair because they're all cunts, basically, in that programme. But, we're a sort of budget Chiswick West London version of it with a bit more humanity and a bit more aesthetic kind of love of life. But there's still a kind of ego eccentric vacuum that we lived under. I was literally just before doing this talking to my sister about it, and she hated that analogy that I made about Succession,
right,
but then agreed with me by the end. And it's just about having somebody that's unbridled in there. You're marginalized by their pathological need to sort of move forward, not even in a triumphant way, but just as that's how they survive. Dad survived with one, he had one trajectory. And if that trajectory wasn't completed or followed, then he would sink. So he didn't have a choice. There's quite a lot of psychological motivation that's unseen, and he had a really weird upbringing and all this stuff, so that its motivation is different from my motivation, because what he did, I guess, more or less created a different type of provision, made a different space for us to grow in. So the knock-on effect is different, and that's quite interesting to watch. So his intentions were good, Yeah. But he was, he was, you know, he was crazy and he was egotistical and he was brilliant and all those
things. Yeah, yeah.
And I think a lot of the time people would really admire that, but that's also a huge burden because it doesn't give you a lot of choice.
Yeah.
To appreciate being a parent. And whereas I have the choice of being a parent and I'm a bit of a, you know, I do my, I look after my kid or I'm, he's my priority. But in dad's world, it wasn't, we, you know, we were either work for him or we're his audience or whatever. But look, I can afford to write a book about it, which maybe Cosmo couldn't. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like I'm not moaning about it. I'm saying it's a different set of extreme circumstances. And they were quite crazy sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I lived in this house eventually on my own with a very tall, he was a sort of an ex-roadie called the Sulfate Strangler.
Yeah, right.
Because I was so naughty that dad thought it was quite a good social experiment for me to stay here. And I eventually got thrown out of some because I went to a private school around the corner and Strangler used to drive me to this school. And the book concentrates on that period.
Yeah, yeah. How old were you? How old were you then?
Well, the story's sort of meant to focus on from about 15 to 14 to 16.
Right, wow.
But and then eventually the Strangler, he died in a police cell in Bournemouth in the end.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God.
It's quite sort of sad in a way.
Yeah,
and so what actually you start doing is quite, you think is quite what you've, because you've tailored these stories over your life as a as a sort of dinner party anecdote.
Yeah.
When you delve into them, you realise, oh, my God, there's a bleak quality.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of people can identify with that in much less colourful ways. But I think we were all like, our home lives growing up were a certain way. And then it's only when you start regaling that to someone that you go, oh, no, that's weird, isn't it? That's not right.
That's abuse.
You build to the big punchline and it's like, they're like, that was horrible. You should probably see someone and talk to them. But you're it was funny.
That's how I thought it was. And then actually when I read, my manager's quite good. She's quite hardcore. And she said, when I tell her, I said, I think it's bleak and I'm a bit worried and I'm not sure. And she went, darling, no one wants to hear about a happy child. Bleak is good. Carry on. Okay, so that's the best advice I had about it.
Yeah,
so it's pretty bleak, and it's quite funny. And I'm, but I did the I left school at 14, really. So I don't know if my grammatical kind of it was a big impact doing this. About I didn't know what a semicolon was, or I didn't. You know what I mean? And then,
I mean, don't worry. I don't either. And I went to uni, so I don't. Before we get onto the album, just a couple more sort of like musical questions about like how you got going, really, and like when did you? Because I've read loads of stuff about how like the kind of music that's being played in the house growing up. There's a lot of like soul and a lot of funk and hip hop and stuff like that. That you grew up on. But obviously it was a bit later when you decided to make a career out of being a musician. So what kind of stuff was you maybe listening to around the time that you decided I'm going to give this a go?
I think by the time I'd started to take it more and more seriously, I sort of took it more seriously by failing everything else, really. there was sort of, I removed all the choices and it's the only thing left that I knew inherently I loved. And I hadn't really listened to anything indie or like Bowie's or Beatles. And we were kind of deprived of that stuff because dad's generation were more, they wanted to be like Funkadelic and stuff. And they weren't, but that's what they sort of saw punk. They thought that was punk, really.
Kind
of soul bands from the early 70s that were all being crazy and Sly and the Stone. So I think that's where their kind of punk came from. So they couldn't be those bands because of their Britishness.
Mm.
But they but that's where the and I didn't know much about anything. I didn't know. I hadn't heard Bowie and I hadn't really listened to Beat until I was in my mid-20s, really.
It was
amazing to have an amazing education about music and jazz and John Coltrane, all these things that I know loads about. and totally attached to, but it was also brilliant to suddenly learn Bowie, especially in the Velvet Underground, and you know, all these things is kind of what sounded really thin to me, these thin, you know, thin brittle bands that I grew to love. So that's what I think, you know, I adopted all those things, or that's what really inspired me in the end as well.
Yeah.
All of it anyway, yeah. But it was quite good to come. It was really a good realization not to be an indie kid in a way.
Yeah, about it
and leave it really late and leave it. And it still sounds quite fresh to me in a weird way.
Yeah.
It sounds like we weren't really allowed to. It was almost like we weren't allowed to listen to it. It was very frowned upon.
Well, anything I was going to ask. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
The Smiths would, you know, you wouldn't be listening to the Smiths at home.
Yeah.
He was quite powerful, but he just, his critique could be strong and leave like a strong.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask that and also relate it to with your son now, with Cosmo now, like there's that old sort of cliche or feeling or whatever that you sort of rebel against your parents' taste to a degree and you kind of go the other way. How did that play out in your house with your dad being kind of trailblazing musician like himself and sort of somebody who was very clear in his tastes? And, you know, I read a great piece that you did with The Quietus, I think it was, where you picked like 13 albums.
Yeah, I read that.
Some of the ones you mentioned, Sly and the Family Stone, and you talk about going to see the Beastie Boys in that. And what was it like when you were kind of making these discoveries and striking out on your own in terms of musical taste? And yeah, how did that all play out?
Hip hop was just something magical to us. You know, like being from around here, growing up Hammersmith and places like that, and all these little there were loads of venues around here, and all the first hip hop bands would come around here, and Tim Westwood had a show on LWR, I think it was called.
Right. Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah.
The first time he had it, you could only get it for 2 hours. I think it was only 2 hours a week, and it was like a pirate radio station.
Yeah,
and they'd play all those electro albums.
Yeah, wow.
And I thought that was just I think it still sounds just unbelievably amazing. Every single bit of it. Every single bit of music made, from the cheesy hip hop to the sort of weirder, more obscure hip hop, all was just absolutely amazing. All amazing right up till probably recently. Even now it's coming, you know, there's so many good things that have happened recently back in hip hop, really. But I think that is the most, when as a young person was the most impressionable.
Yeah.
Electro one or two, or African Bambata and things like that.
Yeah.
Or there was this whole go-go movement. Do you remember the Washington go-go?
No, I don't think. I think that's a new one on me.
They were like this offshoot kind of funk. They were live funk.
Oh, wow.
Washington.
Nice.
They came out in like the mid 80s. And that was a whole movement as well.
Yeah.
They came up with that kind of hip hop thing, but that was all a big live thing.
Yeah.
So was that
connected to the stuff you grew up with? Because there are those links with funk and you're talking about that kind of thing. Or did that feel like that was your thing? Did you feel, like in terms of...
Definitely our thing, but it was allowed to happen. I mean, I'm actually really bullshitting here because I'm making him sound tyrannical, because he wasn't tyrannical at all. He's a total teddy bear.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really bad. But I think that, that felt probably an extension of that culture coming from America.
Yeah,
so Dad would have really liked it. He would have got into it.
Yeah, yeah. I know what you mean, though, when somebody's, as you were saying, if someone's critique can just be so devastating that they don't need to be tyrannical. Like, they can just be dismissive of something and you never want to listen. You don't hear it in the same way anymore.
Yeah.
Contaminated.
Yeah, contaminated, yeah. Which I guess sort of brings us on to, love to get onto your album that you've chosen to...
Just before we do, Jim, I want to just quickly ask about, like, obviously you had a huge smorgasbord of stuff that you would have seen live growing up because of your dad's work. What was there that stood out to you as, like, early live gigs that you went to? Because I want to ask you a couple of questions about you as a live act, but I just wondered if there's something that you took early on as like, do you remember like a first gig that you went to where you was really like, wow, this is something that I absolutely love that you didn't ever fathom?
I mean, not be, to be tethered to dad constantly, but that was always brilliant. Yeah. They were always brilliant. And even as a young person, it was just awe-inspiring when they were on form. Yeah. When they were a young, hungry band, and I was tiny, we went on tour with them and stuff, and we lived, like, the three kids would live at the end of the hotel bed. Like, literally, we'd like, live in a formation around the end of the hotel bed. So we were pretty feral gig kids, so we saw it a lot. That was always incredible. And then I got into things like Madness, and they were always amazing. And then, I remember Beastie Boys. I remember seeing their first gig. I think it was at the Hammersmith Odeon, actually. That was incredible.
Right.
Yeah. I think what's incredible is what you're into, right? What you're like, what you were really into. All those bands. I mean, it's quite a simple format, isn't it? That early hip hop thing, but you're 14 or 13. It just sounds amazing that you're going to see your own. I think the Beastie Boys were the best gig I'd ever seen.
And what do you remember about that? Do you remember like going, like who got the tickets out of you? Who did you go with? How did it like come about? Because it's not like now you just like, bomb, it's on your phone. You're going to the gig. Do you remember anything particular about going to see that Beastie Boys gig?
Yeah, I mean, it was Hammersmith Odeon, which was next door. It's called the Odeon. It's now called the, whatever it's called, the Hammersmith Apollo. The Odeon. It would have been my little crew, all rubbish, stupid, ridiculously dressing up box. Hats. A sort of an Americanized impression of, we would have looked like proper knocks, you know what I mean?
I think you compared it to Harry Enfield characters in The Quietest Thing, which made me laugh. Kevin and Perry sort of toddling around in like oversized three stripes and Sam Smiths and all that.
We were kind of this crossover crew from Ladbroke Grove to here. We all had these ridiculous sort of urban, you know, what we tailored accents that had all gone a bit warped, and we said stupid stuff, and you know, we were really into it. And we all had we used to nickel the VW signs of the cars.
Oh wow.
And stuff like that. I mean, you know what happened? When I see all the photos, it's quite funny, is everyone else had a sort of instinct that naturally was able to sort of fashion blend. And somehow I was like the guy in the band that always got it wrong, the kind of Gary Barlow type. I always had a pair of chef's trousers on or something, not a waistcoat, and it never really worked.
Jim, who would you say in our group was that person in our group?
Oh, impossible to say, mate. Impossible to say.
Are you two old mates from years ago?
Yeah, we went to school together.
Where did you go to school?
Bexley Heath.
South East London. Did you? That's wicked.
Yeah, that's amazing.
We're
still really good. Our little group of mates are all still, and I'm the one that always turns up in the weird blazer or whatever. Still, or like just a tash or whatever. I mean, I'm wearing a pale pink.
Always has been. Yeah.
I got a photo next to me actually because we were going through them all because of the book, and it shows me. There's the Strangler, the guy I lived with.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
A mate of mine in Mohican. And there's me with a rubbish sort of baker's hat on. I just got it all wrong. He looks amazing.
Look at the mohawk. That's incredible.
That was so funny.
Is that an earring as well? Is that like a little...
I got loads of earrings there.
Somewhere in this room, I've almost got a hat identical to that. I can't find it.
Anyway, it's funny.
So I just want to quickly ask you about you as a live act, because me and Jimmy have seen you a couple of times together. I've probably seen you about four times, and you're always doing something a bit strange in terms of, I think I saw you at Festival Number 6 and you had like a sort of spinning off helicopter thing that you were trying to get going and some bubbles. We saw you come out what's that one in East London that we went to, Jim? The first time that we saw back. So you came out and you had loads of blow up dolls and you were like wrapped up in some like silver tape or something. The dance in the suits, the dancing. So I just wondered, like, do you just kind of go with a feeling and go, oh, tonight I'm going to take this on and see what happens? Or is it quite carefully planned out, or what's going on?
No, it's quite raw. And so it's, you know, it has a sort of quality dips and peaks. You know, there's moments where you go, it looks like it's kind of thought about, and that's quite good. And then a lot of the time it just looks stupid. But you know, it's pretty, and it's also just compensatory, I think, is what you'd call it. It's like the music's kind of weirdly divided up between a lot of other people's efforts. And so I have this small sort of narrative spots in the music, and I'm not that much of a competent musician. I'm quite self-depreciating today, but, and so there's these little, you know, I have these little moments, and then there's quite a lot of spare sort of, spare air or whatever they call it, and and I try and find things to do that don't dismantle, don't take the attention away too much from the music, and I don't always get it right, and I guess that's the what the fuck am I doing now.
You don't want to get
too much of a shopping list syndrome where you go, who am I, how old am I, what am I doing, am I, does anyone like me, and you can sort of perish or marry, you know, start perishing.
If it's any use to you, I've kind of like almost taken quite affected some of your like stage presence, as it were, into what I do. Like I've really gone, I want to wear those kind of suits, and I kind of want to move a bit when I'm doing stand up. And so it's bled into another art form now, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, you've got a lot to answer for, Baxter, basically. No, but I think it's really interesting to hear you talk about it in terms of being quite raw, and that to add that element of like unpredictability to it. And I think it's a weird thing, gig performance, isn't it? And it's kind of, and it's quite rigid, isn't it? Like there's all these, and so if people can like muck about with that a bit, it's a lot more compelling. I saw in another interview, I think you were talking about Sleaford Mods, it might have been the quietest one again, and like they might just be in my head because I listened to a recent podcast interview with them. But you know, they almost do a similar thing in another way, didn't they, with the kind of, you know, just pressing play, and then the kind of, and it is that thing where it sort of it disrupts your feeling of what's going to happen, and there is the sort of showmanship with the white suit, but then it's kind of, and I guess it ties in with the mix of art and reality that you've sort of played with over the last few albums, and kind of that really interesting dance that you've kind of danced really between like what is real and the literal dance and the kind of, you know, people in my, you know, I'm a journalist and people in my profession are always trying to pin stuff down to, so which bit of this is literally about you and which bit of this is about the breakup or moving here or doing this, and we're trying to join the dots. And so it's I think there is something very striking about blurring those lines and making it a bit confusing and sort of unsettling people, as you were saying.
And also, Go on, you go. No, I was just going to say, and also on top of that, sometimes it's really refreshing to see somebody have a bit of contempt for the audience. Like, I remember you coming on and just like the first thing you did was cough into the mic and then go, well, you're here, you might as well clap. And just things like that, I absolutely love. I'm like, that's so good. To have, because everyone's like, I'm so pleased to be here, and I really like to see this other, like, well, I'm just at work, it's up to you what you want to do about it.
I don't know how organized that is, or how much that is just a response to fear sometimes, or the dead spaces and stuff I was talking about, but and also that I think I have a sort of obstructive flow of my organized thoughts, and probably why I didn't do very well at school and other sociological circumstances, but the and I have to sort of turn that into an energy, and the only thing I have is a sort of free-flowing kind of broken valve of bullshit that I can use to my advantage. And I don't know what to do with that. I mean, every time we're playing in Europe and I don't remember my lyrics, I'm sort of upset by how much nonsense I talk, and I can stream out an hour and a half absolute fucking bullshit. And sometimes I go, oh, bravo, I love this thing about the frozen chicken singing. I'm like, did I say frozen chicken? You look back on the video and I talked about frozen, whatever. And it's incredible that how much bullshit and actually how much of it, it's about an energy, not about the words.
Yeah,
you were talking about Jason, who's actually amazing at in between faking it and not faking it, but he's so
Jason from Sleaford Mods, obviously.
From Sleaford Mods, he's so precision at kind of creating that feeling that he might be scrambling. And I've actually just listening to their, I've just spoken to him actually, because I just listened to their new song and it's actually pretty brilliant. And he's nailed himself.
That character
almost perfectly, almost absolutely. He's like a Russian ballet dancer.
Yeah.
Very smart and very brilliant. Very raw source of information coming at you. It's very, very, very good. And it's not
You're right.
It's not an accident. And that's actually when you start to study, you go, fucking hell, he's bloody brilliant.
Yeah, he's so good on Pan Amsterdam's new album as well. Have you heard that?
No.
Oh, so you good. Would because that's great hip hop. He's a really good guy, actually, Pan Amsterdam. But Jason's on I think two of the tracks on that album.
Okay, check out.
Yeah.
How new is that?
It came out like maybe a month ago.
Okay, I'll look at it. Check it out.
So let's talk about, because we've had John Fraser, we haven't even started talking about what we're supposed to be talking about. As with this podcast, everybody will know that we get on a revered musician to talk about an album that's dear to them or special to them in some way or that they just love or love at the moment. So Baxter, do you want to tell us what you've brought in to share with the podcast today?
Yeah, it's called it's just called Nancy and Lee, isn't it? I always don't know.
Is that what?
I mean, I always get I'm so badly researched on the things I like. I always I know that if you say Lee and Nancy, no one knows what you're talking about.
People just
I go Lee. I always get it wrong way around. And I'm going,
that's like a CBeebies show or something. They get really confused. Like,
what is Nancy Lee? And I, you know, I used it as quite a soundtrack when in peak claustrophobic lockdown, I started running around Richmond Park quite a lot. And that was just the most bonkers thing to listen to. And there were certain points I'd reach and then it would go into a, because it varies. It goes into quite bonkers music.
Second half, especially. Psychedelic-y.
Weird time structures. And then, you know, and then it's everything about it is ambiguous and strange and weird. Sexualized and.
Look at us, but do not touch. Fedra is my name.
Some will. And then it's got this looming presence of Frank, who we all know like definitely killed people. You know what I mean? So then you've got that about it, and then I just everything about the album, everything about the era, everything about the sound. It's just unbelievable, really. The most obvious version. Of say Lee Hazelwood's work. His goes off into all sorts of obscurities. She, I guess he sort of found a fame through her a little bit.
He was doing a lot of these boots for her at the behest of her dad, and that was the start of the relationship.
But I don't think there's any evidence of them being involved, or they were.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't know. I think maybe it was a bit of a. I mean, that is kind of the deliberate suggestion from, you know, the entire, you know, their sort of, their relationship as their professional relationship or whatever was this kind of hinged on this kind of will they, won't they, badinage, and forth. But yeah, from what I could see, I don't think anything did actually happen. But Lee Hazelwood.
He wasn't allowed to, though.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
he wouldn't be, you wouldn't brag about that, would you? You know what I mean?
But no, thank you so much for suggesting this, because it's one of those albums, one of those records that I think I've known about Lee Hazlewood, and he's such a touchstone and reference point for a lot of musicians. I know that Nick Cave and people like Jarvis Cocker, even Beck are the famous ones. But I know around the time of Alex Turner and Miles Kane doing Last Shadow Puppets, and I know Lee Hazlewood was like a reference for that, and his whole sort of cowboy. It sort of feels it's that kind of late 60s, bit of Wall of Sound, kind of poppy, but also, as you say, like really totally twisted unique. And dark and strange. Yeah. Well, and it was fantastic.
He's one of those people that people try and sort of grab from and no one can get near him.
Yeah.
I mean, she was actually equally brilliant.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
She's many of them. Yeah. And it's really psychedelic. It's really rock and roll music. And then it's really traditional, isn't it? Really traditional.
Country.
But I read somewhere that he produced that song. What's the song that Frank and Nancy sing, which is hugely ambiguous?
Yes, is it Something Stupid?
Something Stupid, which has got the weirdest narrative. But because I always thought that she was his girlfriend, but she's his daughter.
Yeah,
right?
I know. It's really weird.
When you listen to
that,
that's pretty fucking screwy.
Yeah. It really is.
So there's a whole weird lot of shit going on between all of them.
Yeah, really strange dynamic. I found an amazing quote in a piece about Lee Hazlewood, because he lived a fascinating life. And I was wondering in terms of, how much you know about him and in terms of his influence and what you're sort of particularly drawn to. But he lived a really fascinating life and, you know, just moved to Sweden for 10 years late on in his career and was quite, he was kind of all about making money and selling royalties to stuff and tax problems and womanizer and all these kind of things.
Cynical.
He was a real rogue. Yeah, he was quite cynical and quite unashamed about it, even though he's clearly such a songwriting genius. But his note to Nancy, I think for These Boots, was sing it like you're a 14-year-old who fucks truck drivers. So that's the kind of guy that we're dealing with. So thank you it's such a the dynamic, and I guess it's one of those things that if you delve too deep, it's like, you know, late 60s kind of, there is this kind of freedom, but then it has this very dark tins to it as well.
Maybe it's not worth investigating.
I think so.
Stay away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Cancel culture.
What was your kind of first discovery of this album? Where did you first kind of hear it? When did you first become aware of Lee Hazlewood and this record? And what's your kind of history with it?
A funny anecdote, and this is quite sort of celeb anecdote, but I was with, who's a mate of mine, Jarvis, who's a mate of mine, and I was in Paris once.
Oh, amazing.
And he invited me over to go and watch the World Cup, whenever the World Cup was.
Oh, wow, amazing.
And he went, come over. And I
came. and you and Jarvis are in, just briefly, you're in that same club of like massive, like French people love you. You've got this kind of strange thing where you're kind of.
So I'm over there a lot, and he's always an appreciate, you know, nice person to hang out with, because he's just sort of calm and nice to be there. And he's got a nice gap. And I went into, he went to invite me over to watch the, I shouldn't say it, but we watched the football. And he had some M&S spicy hummus. We had some spicy hummus. And then he tried to turn on his TV, and he hadn't turned it on for about 10 years, and it was all locked off. I sort of feigned an interest in the football to some extent, and he got a bit bored, and in the end he just played Lee Hazlewood records. I was sat there till about 2 o'clock in the morning. He sort of DJ'd and I ate some spicy and it was really, we were both wearing really like unnaturally hot suits, and it was really hot. We were like sweating. We were like malaria,
spicy hummus.
Like a sitcom, isn't it? And he just played this load of, it's just such an amazing DJ. And he played all the stuff, and a load of Lee Hazlewood stuff. And he's got these beautiful old Tannoy speakers. And it was just a real moment. I didn't really say much.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
I gazed off into something. Just it was really, something like, triggered, you know.
Better
than the football, to be honest.
Yeah. Probably almost certainly was. thank you. I mean, in terms of we play a track, we put a drop a track in from it. Is there one in particular that stands out for you?
Where's the playlist? Where's the what's the one about wine?
Is it Summer Wine?
Yeah, play that one.
Summer Wine.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah. I know. I'm so unnerdy that I never read the things or read the thing or
no. No, I know what you mean though, but
I listen to albums a lot, but I never learn the song titles and stuff.
Yeah, right. Jimmy's the opposite. Jimmy will learn every single lyric, everything.
Just like obsessive about it. Like, you know, my wife gets one word of like a title wrong and I'm like, you know, actually it's to the river. Yeah. The divorce will come through soon. It'll be over. Yeah.
What I also find slightly interesting about this, and maybe it's that classic thing of you're looking for something in it, because we just got sent over what your album choice was. Obviously, we hadn't chatted to you beforehand, and you're thinking, oh, I wonder why he's picked this. And you're like, I can see some parallels between the sounds as well, of like obviously the complete contrast between like the deep sort of sinisterness of your style versus your two girls in the band. And you think, oh, yeah, you can see a little bit of that as well.
Definitely. There's a sleazy sort of sleaziness to it and a kind of ambiguity to it. Yeah. And the sonicness to it. I mean, but more or less probably by accident, but there's definitely something there I can hear.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. I think he's somebody that was compared to or kind of bracketed with Serge Gainsbourg. And I know that that's someone that has been a sort of, you know, that you've been compared to in like France and stuff. And yeah, that it's interesting, that sleazy and that kind of contrast and being funny as well. It was in, I think you said earlier when you were talking about your childhood and particularly those years kind of in the house that you're in now and it being sort of bleak but funny. And I was like thinking, oh wow, that seems like quite a good description of like your music in some ways. And sort of there's that, both things are happening at the same time and there's a lot going on. And yeah, I definitely would doing the same as Joe and being like, oh, I wonder why he's picked this or whatever. And so it is interesting and it's something that we always find when we interview musicians for this pod and they suggest things and they could be recent discoveries or they could be things that they've listened to for years. And there's normally some subconscious crossover or something that was out in the ether that you've kind of tapped into as well. And you sort of sense an affinity in like another act. So yeah, it's really, really, really good.
Interesting.
It's an identifying factor, isn't it? Yeah, you don't always know it yourself, but
yeah completely.
Happy and bleak, without and the right side of sleazy, not the horrible side of sleazy.
The fun side.
Yeah,
it's a laugh kind of sleazy.
Yeah, exactly.
Good lad. I guess I just kind of wanted to ask you as well before we let you go about, because you said like obviously
my kids
dropped out of school at 14 and stuff.
Well, so apologise in advance if a three-year-old runs in and starts bellowing.
Like you said, oh, you left school like around 14 and you've never really been much of a person for school and education and stuff, but you have such wonderful turns of phrase. Where do you think that comes from? I always really love when it's like the minutiae of things that you comment on and the turns of phrase, I think are one of like the absolutely incredible things about your work. And I just wondered where you think that comes from. It's quite often it tends to come from school, or like education.
We were just brought up with language. I mean, we were like what you called, you know, I mean, it's such a tired way of explaining yourself that my granny explained us, actually. We're kind of arts and crafts people made up of all those there was no real undefinable this, you know, we're all sorts of people. You know, the granddad was an East End bus driver, boxer, and my granny was a doctor, and dad was whoever he was. And so I guess we were just surrounded by, you know, books and learning and conversation and talking, and dad was pretty well read and mum was well read. They all went to art school and all those sort of pretensions. You know, is that a little small?
Yeah.
That's really
funny. Barricade them. Yeah, he's going to come in and start but asking you. Yeah. Yeah, he really loves Lee Hazelwood, so he's a person. Oh, really? No, I'm joking.
But I guess it's all that sort of, you know, it's a cult. You grow up, don't you, in a culture of that.
You grow up in a culture. And just one final thing that I've got, unless you've got anything, Jimmy, is just I love the sort of way that you straddle between, you've got this very working class ideals from your upbringing and stuff, but obviously you've had slightly more comfortable life as an adult or whatever. And I just really love how you kind of sit. It's something that fascinates me, in between almost like working class and middle class as an act. Yeah,
I'm never a class imposter, and I think, and I love it when people call me a Motley. I'm like, yeah, I am. I am the definition. You know, yeah. I was the first inventor because there were those people around when we grew up, and maybe I don't know where the transition point of me talking a bit gravelly was, but I think I always spoke like this. Probably dad probably invented his accent more than I did, and there was poverty, and then there was money, and you know all that stuff. So we had everything, and in droves, so we had nothing in droves as well as having things. Anyway, the point is that I don't ever try and suggest I'm anything really.
But I guess just the byproduct of all of that makes it, because there's not a lot of that in the music industry as such that you get to see, and I just think it's so fascinating that you exist, like something I can really identify with. I think it's really great. It's not really a question,
but I think it gets bad when people feel disingenuous or something, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
When people are disingenuous about who they are. I don't know if they're right about having a go at the idols. I'd get out of it.
I don't understand.
How you measure people's working classness and stuff.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, whatever.
Yeah. It does seem like there is a bit of a popular part of the discourse where people are like forever trying to point out that people's credentials don't neatly match what they're talking about in their songs, and certain people have a right to talk about certain things and certain people don't. And it feels like a bit of a side effect of kind of social media discourse where people are constantly straining to prove that they're kind of less privileged than they actually are and how hard they've had it to a degree. It does seem like a bit of a sort of modern preoccupation in some ways. And you're right, like, you know, people do move through different parts of life, and it's not just as cut and dry as you say with your family, like, you know, had one sort of upbringing, but there was like lots of creativity, and like, you know, it's really interesting to look at it in that way. The one thing I wanted to ask was, you were so, I think I've noticed from a lot of the quotes from when you were interviewed for the last album that you were saying, it kind of felt like an endpoint for that. I think you might have described it as a kind of bloke trilogy, like kind of the preceding two albums, and that you were maybe going to have to craft a new way of doing things, or that it was, yeah, that it felt like a bit of a full stop in terms of you'd found such a sort of potent way of doing things in such a specific lane. And then, what's the update on that then? Has that kind of changed over the course of the year since the album came out? And
no, I think it's time to do, you know, you mustn't think you're not anything different than what you are, but you must try and get, you know, I can't be another bloke talking over an orchestra, going, blah, 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 you know, blah, 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 blah. I just don't think I could, I think other people might continue that genre on better than I would, and I would just like to feel like I could do something different. And also, I'm not, you know, I feel a bit pigeonholed in a sort of indie grubby world, and I like to, but you mustn't presuppose that that's your right to be anywhere else. So let's see what happens. You just go off and make some music.
Yeah,
and
right.
It'll
yeah,
probably
yeah,
yeah. sound exactly the same to everyone else, and I'll just fool myself into thinking that it's different. But,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I quite like kind of Frank Oceans and people like that. I like
yeah,
that
whole,
yeah.
I mean, I love all that shit. You know, I think that's
yeah,
quite
yeah, yeah.
weird and so I don't know how that fits in yet, but I've just rented yeah. the studio actually, so I start tomorrow.
Oh, oh fantastic!
Great. So that's
oh,
good.
Brilliant!
Well, well, I'd like to get.
I can't
away
wait
anyway.
To hear it. Yeah,
we'll do another one.
That'd be great.
That'd be amazing. Thank you for being so generous with your time. This has been really amazing. Yeah,
thank you.
It's been lovely.
Yeah.
It's been
really, really lovely speaking to you. And good luck. I really can't wait to read the book as well. Like,
yeah. Totally. Oh, just before we go, so my wife is a drag king,
yeah.
right? And for a
that
for
sounds a book, like an album title if ever I've heard
for,
it.
For a book about your dad, an art book.
Yeah,
he got photographed by a photographer as your dad, inspired by Sweet Jean Vincent.
That is brilliant.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it?
Oh, amazing.
That's my first time seeing that.
You've not seen it, have you, Jimmy? Yeah.
No, that's incredible.
Wow. Drag King as well. What's the book called?
All Kinds of Naughty. It's
that's a brilliant
guy called,
book.
It's a collection of artists, but the guy that took my wife's pictures, Dean Chalkley, he does all the like NME covers
and
stuff.
Yeah. For a while, yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
You know what? It's nice talking to you because you're old mates. It makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Oh,
you but if you're talking to two people that are old buddies.
Yeah.
I'm glad you think it's not. I don't think Jim's that keen on it, but I'm.
I'm trying to get rid of him.
No, I think,
you weren't meant to say that, Baxter. No, you're right. It's we've got a lot in the tank. We've been together. So it's really lovely to chat to you.
Yeah, next time you're live somewhere, we'll come and throw you a beer.
Yeah, big time. Yeah,
definitely.
JJ's Album Club.
There we bloody go! What a gent! What a hero! What a man! What a dude! It's become like the meme or the running theme of these interviews. But I cannot wait to go and when he's performing again and when he comes back with some new music, I'm sure and. To go and see him. Yeah. Following up on that. Remember you said that we should go for a drink. We're just holding you to that right now.
You said it.
We've got you on tape. I've just realised that could be the big reveal of this. We just get people on the record to agree to go out for a drink with us. But he was great. He was fantastic. Great choice of album. And yeah, man, it's been really fun, and I feel like
there's one thing that I really regret not getting into that interview that I didn't remember until much later.
always good to reveal these.
Me and Yanina went to Elephant and Castle Bowling.
Oh yes,
and I was wearing a t-shirt with the lyrics to Miami on it that Yanina had got me for a birthday and Christmas.
I am the urban goose for those that
And the lady said, "What's on your T-shirt?" And I said, "Oh, it's a long story." I said, "It's a band." She said, "What band is it?" And I was like, "Oh, it's a guy called Baxter Jury." And like, she was like a middle-aged, like Nigerian lady, and she just like she wasn't. I could tell by just her general demeanour that she wasn't going to be interested. So, and then she was like, "So, what's his name?" And I was like, "Baxter Jury." And she was like, "Okay, I'll check it out. I'll write it down. What's it called?" And I said, "Okay." And I said, "I just don't think it's a very acquired taste." And she said, "No, I'm gonna put it on." And I was like, "I don't recommend that you put it on." And so in Elephant and Castle Bowling Alley at about 6 o'clock on like a Monday night, it's got, you know, all this swearing and she didn't look me in the eye for the rest of the time I was in there. And I forgot to tell him about
that. That is brilliant. We'll have to tell him that next time we see him. But that's perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the effect that he has.
Had it not been shut down, I'd be banned from there.
Yeah, I think that was the final nail in the coffin, wasn't it? That was why they decided to send the wrecking ball in, because it was this den of filth and iniquity.
Yeah.
All right, mate.
But that's the end of the series.
Yes.
We hope that you've enjoyed it. Please don't forget to share it amongst your friends. Who knows when the next series will be with us too. And basically, we feel like if we can get the good guests, then it's worth doing. So we, but you know, I'm not gonna taint the legacy of this.
Yeah, well, let's not.
Someone I've never heard of.
let's not force it. Let's not stress it. We had a great time. Baxter has brought us home in some style, and conversations are happening with some really amazing acts. And if they happen, they're meant to happen.
We'll be back.
And we'll be back. And you will know.
If not, just get on the old... Get on the old, I don't know what Jimmy's up to, but get on the... you can see Jimmy on MasterChef, of course.
Yeah.
Or, you know, all of our social medias.
Yeah.
Joey Page Comedy on Instagram, or The Joey Page on Twitter, or Joey Page Comedy on Twitch.
Yeah, mate.
Go and check out my music show. I'm not going anywhere. I've got a big mouth.
That's true. Yeah, you should. It's very good.
Jimmy's writing a book.
I am. Yeah, I am. Don't remind me. It's got to be great. Yeah. Everything's got to be fine. So cheers, mate.
Do stay in touch. Come and say hello.
Thank you for listening. For all of those of you, the hardcore, that have listened and have enjoyed this, we've absolutely loved doing it. Let's not get too sort of final or valedictory, because, no, you know.
But also, we'll be back soon, if you're just here today, Kai, you've got some good ones to listen to.
Yes. Yes. The treasure trove, the vaults. Yeah. All right,
mate.
We're done.
Thanks,
see
everyone.
You next time
on JJ's album cut.
Bye.
I'm leaving it like that.